after 4, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Joining me for a return visit to Fresh Air is Bob Edgar, the Democratic U.S. Congressman from Delaware County, who's one of the most outspoken liberal voices in the House. Although Pennsylvania's 7th Congressional District is known as a Republican stronghold, he's won the support of the district and is now serving his 4th term. He's the chairman of the Northeast Midwest Coalition, comprised of 200 House members from 18 states working for programs that will help ease the growing economic distress in their areas, and also trying to prevent Sunbelt states from being favored over other areas of the country. Edgar is also the chair of the House Veterans Affairs Subcommittee on Education, Training, and Employment. He wrote the final draft of the Veterans Education Assistance Act of 1981. He's been a supporter of human rights issues and went to El Salvador on a fact-finding mission about a year ago. He's a Methodist minister, and from 1971 to 74, he was the United Protestant chaplain at Drexel University, where he was also the co-founder and co-director of the People's Emergency Center. By the way, if you'd like to meet him and hear him speak, he will be the guest speaker this evening at the Christian Association on the Penn campus as part of the series Personal Values and Public Policy. The subject will be the role of religion in politics. For any more information on this talk, you can call 386-1530. The Christian Association is at 3601 Locust Walk. We're going to be spending the next hour talking about a number of different issues, and we hope, time permitting, to open up the phones a little later for your questions. Bob Edgar, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's good to be here this afternoon.
The last time you were here, we were talking about the moral majority and the effect that they had in the last election and the influence that they were having on the way politics were going in the country. Do you think that since that visit that they have perhaps lost some of their influence?
I think their overexposure over the last 11 months has been helpful to toning down some of the enthusiasm for what they're about. They're still putting out target lists. I'm still targeted for recycling by them. They're still going to raise large sums of money for next year's congressional campaign. And clearly, they're a force to be reckoned with as a one-issue special interest group. But I get the sense from talking with other members of Congress that fewer of us are frightened by their confrontation politics, and more courage is being shown by many of the congressmen who felt threatened by them in the last campaign. I think the general feeling among members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, who are always targeted by the Jerry Falwell types, is that they are to be confronted with the truth. And many of the mainline religious communities, both Protestant and Catholic, are speaking out a little bit more clearly on supporting candidates who are right on human rights and right on civil rights and right on women's rights and right on caring for people, and not getting captured by the political ideologies of a moral majority that focuses primarily on conservative political thought rather than on basic human need.
Do you think conservative congressmen and senators are trying to disentangle themselves at all from the moral majority?
Well, with some statements like Barry Goldwater's statement about Jerry Falwell and others, it's clear that some of them are very uncomfortable with the statements that they're making. And then the president nominated the woman for the Supreme Court, and she, I think, did a good job being conservative, being for many of the things that the moral majority is for, and yet having a sense of integrity separate from that. When the moral majority came out in opposition to her, I think that really hurt their cause. I think that none of us, liberal or conservative, feel that somebody has to be ideologically pure in which to support them. They have to be morally honest. And I think that's the thing that most people are looking for in politicians, elected officials, and appointees.
It was a year ago that Reagan won the presidential election. Now that it's been a year, he hasn't served a full year in office, but it's been a year since the election. What kind of report card would you give him on the policies he's initiated and pushed through?
Well, I'd give him an A on communication skills. I'd give him an A-plus on White House liaison with Congress. I'd give him an A in terms of his ability to persuade congressmen to take difficult positions, like on his win on the AWACS last week, being able to persuade senators to support him, even though most senators knew within their hearts that maybe that was not a good idea. He showed great persuasive powers. I think I would give him a D-plus in terms of economic philosophy. Most of my constituents want to give the president a chance, and I want to give the president a chance. I think most of them feel that the president has a right to put in place his policies, and he's been remarkably successful. He put in place spending cuts on the domestic side, tax cut, and defense increase, and he moved as he tried to for a balanced budget. The problem is there was a major flaw, and this is why I give him a D-plus in terms of his economic theory. He took $35 billion out of the domestic economy, cutting school lunch programs and student loans and human service programs. And in those $35 billion worth of cuts, we didn't touch tobacco subsidies or wasteful water projects. We simply hit many of the programs that are important to urban centers like Philadelphia. Had we just done that and saved the American taxpayer $35 billion, we might have cause to applaud. But what the average citizen doesn't recognize is we turned around and spent all of that plus more, $10 billion more, and we committed ourselves to $45 billion of additional spending in defense. Over 5 years, we're going to spend $1.6 trillion, so that every dollar of domestic savings and more are being spent on the defense system, so that the federal government next year, this year, will be spending more money rather than less. Then we turned around and gave everybody everything they wanted in a tax cut. $50 billion of revenues were reduced by a tax cut for individuals and for business. What many people don't realize is every dollar of that tax cut is borrowed, and it increases our deficit. And rather than the president's projection in July of a $42.5 billion deficit, our deficit by all accounts, Reagan, Senator Baker, David Stockman, Secretary Reagan, is that it's going to be $80 billion or more. An $80 billion deficit this year means that the federal government will be borrowing $400 million a day to fund its defense program and to fund its basic policy. Interest rates, in my opinion, will stay between 17 and 22% for the next 6 months. It's going to have catastrophic impact on small business, catastrophic impact on real estate and on building and construction trades, catastrophic impact on the auto industry. So while the president's been very successful in his communication skills, I think the flaw of supply-side economics is going to come back to haunt him. And we see signs of that. We see signs of that now with the president coming back and saying maybe we need, quote, revenue enhancement measures, which is a code word for tax increases. Or maybe we need to cut 12% more domestic spending. Or maybe we need to roll back some of the defense input. Or even as Senator Hines has said, let's roll back some of the individual tax cut that we gave away, because that's the only way we'll save revenue. So I think Wall Street and the money markets, even the new Nobel Peace Prize winner for economics, has said, I don't understand what Reagan is about if he's not really reducing spending, simply shifting it from domestic to defense expenditures. And I don't understand why he's given so much of the tax cut away when we have to borrow the money for that tax cut. So he gets an A for one communication, but he gets a D plus in his economic theory.
When he was lobbying for that first round of budget cuts and tax cuts, a lot of people who wouldn't ordinarily have voted for him did because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, I guess, because he's such an excellent lobbyer. But two, probably because they felt that their constituency would want them to come out in support of the president, and it seemed like it might be dangerous to come out against him since so many people thought that his victory over Carter was a great indication of the way the American public was turning. But now that it seems that there will be such a big deficit in spite of this economic program, do you have any sense that any of the people who voted for Reagan's policies are second-guessing that decision and are maybe sorry that they did it?
Yeah, I think the key group is a group that we call the Gypsy Moths. There's a lot of press about the boll weevils, who are the Southern conservative Democrats who voted with the president. They're basically hawks on defense, and they, over the years, have not supported many of the human service programs. But there's a new group emerging, and these are the moderate Republicans, people like Sil Conti from Massachusetts or Claudine Schneider from Rhode Island, or in Pennsylvania, people like Arlen Specter, John Hines, Larry Coughlin, Joe McDade, congressmen and senators who, while they supported the president on his budget and tax cuts, are now saying, we have to make some mid-course corrections. We either have to be careful when we're cutting more domestic programs to include tobacco subsidies, sugar subsidies, peanut subsidies, and water projects. And yesterday they had a vote in the Senate where the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway was up. And it was interesting to see Senator Baker lobbying for additional spending for a project like that. But Arlen Specter and John Hines voting right to cut funds from that project because they recognize we've got to cut equally across the country. We also find those moderate Republicans saying, Mr. President, there is waste, fraud, and abuse in the Defense Department, and before we go and help you cut any more programs out of the heart of the Northeast, let's see you demonstrate some interest in cutting back on that defense expenditure. And we even have people like John Hines saying, maybe we ought to roll back the individual tax cut and hold off for 3 months or 6 months until we can get the budget in line. So I think you're going to find some leadership in that moderate Republican group that helped the president with the initial package, helped him with the tax and the budget proposal, but are now saying, Mr. President, we're not going to go any further with this until we can really focus on high interest rates and focus on what you're doing with the deficit.
Do you think additional social service cuts could ever pass?
Well, it depends on where they are. You know, I don't think that the moderate Republicans will accept any additional cuts in low-income fuel assistance or food stamps or those type of things unless they see equal cuts in some of the programs that the president was able to keep in the budget to get his votes from the Southern conservative Democrats and Republicans.
Speaking with Congressman Robert Edgar, if you're just joining us, I'm sure that the president didn't directly approach you about the AWACS package. I'm sure he wrote you off as being a pretty hopeless vote. But I'm sure, on the other hand, that you know people who he did approach. What impression do you have of his lobbying skill? What is it that he does that at the 11th hour he can get people to vote his way on a very sensitive issue?
Well, first of all, on the AWACS lobbying effort, the president ignored the House completely. It wasn't just the Bob Edgars of this world. We voted 301 to 111 not to sell the AWACS planes to Saudi Arabia. And we did so in a bipartisan way, across ideological lines, primarily because we sell that plane to no other nation on planet Earth. And many of us felt that it would be very destabilizing in that part of the world if that plane, very sensitive in its intelligence equipment, fell into the hands not so much of the Russians but of a more radical Ayatollah similar to Ayatollah Khomeini or Mr. Gaddafi from Libya or one of the other radical nations, and what kind of reaction the Israelis would have if that particular thing would occur. And we felt that if the planes are going to be used, they ought to either be under complete control of the United States or under joint command situations like we have in the Allied forces. The president, recognizing that he could not win it in the House and only needing one of the two bodies, put all of his effort, all of his direction into the Senate. And what he did was he knew those senators who were clearly against him and those senators who were clearly for him, and he just simply eliminated them from discussion. He pulled his wagons around the offices of those who were on the borders. And he individually brought them into the Oval Office and directed a major effort at them. I thought Senator Heflin's comments were particularly enlightening. He has a Southern drawl, and he was saying, he said, I've been lobbied on this more than anything else. In fact, my arm's been twisted so much that I think I need an arm transplant. And essentially, the president just went back over and over, put his integrity on the line, put the office of the presidency on the line, and you had some incredible changes. For example, you had the senator who stood up before the Jewish community at their Washington conference with the ambassador from Israel give a speech on how terrible the AWACS vote was. This is Senator Jepson. You find him going up to New York and other places raising money because he was such an anti-AWACS senator. In the last weekend before the vote, he changes his mind and supports the president. And I think you had a number of examples of those kinds of people who just, when it got down to, are you with me or against me, apart from the merits of the AWACS, the president was able to get people to say, I'm with you. And it's just a great skill on his part to be able to look somebody in the eye and say, you know, I need you for national security reasons, or I need you because I gave my word.
Is that mostly it, that feeling of I need you, or do you think there were also deals being made?
Some were deals. If it was a secret ballot, the president would have lost. Because it was a public vote and because he was able to twist arms, he was able to do it. There were some deals made. Clearly, the Clinch River Breeder Reactor and the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway and peanut supports and sugar supports and tobacco supports all entered into some of the decision-making process. And I think behind the scenes, we have some evidence that there were water projects involved here and there that the president will eventually come out for. And the president has a lot of power. Jimmy Carter didn't use it very well. Other presidents like Richard Nixon have used it well. And I think Ronald Reagan simply turned on the forces. And if you're a senator from a state who has a particular need, cleaning up a toxic disposal site in your state or a particular urban problem or a defense installation you want to keep in your state, there's just a lot of leverage that the president can make on his agencies to put pressure on you to vote with him.
Do you think that that's a fair way of getting people to vote in the Congress? Or I know that he's been very impressive in getting the votes that he has, but do you approve of those tactics?
I don't approve of the tactics when they move into the area of pork barreling. I think that the president has a right and a responsibility to try to get his point across. But I think we're all grown men and women in the House and Senate, and we ought to make decisions based on the merits of those issues and what's in the best interest of the nation. And unfortunately, when we get down to these tight votes like this, some of the people who are voting are not necessarily voting for what's right for the nation. They're voting for what's right for their reelections or for their particular political survival. And I'm not very proud of that.
Okay, if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Congressman Bob Edgar, and we're going to be covering a number of issues until we join National Public Radio at 5 o'clock, and time permitting, we'll open up the phones a little bit later. Does the polls seem to show Reagan losing popularity? Is that affecting the way people are thinking and the way they're going to be voting?
I think that there are some signs of slippage in the polls by the president, but I don't think we should underestimate the power of the presidency to rebound. I think the assassination attempt kept his honeymoon going a little longer than normal, and I think he smiles well and he's a good communicator, and I think people genuinely like him. And even when his administration stumbles, he has the capacity to blame somebody else for the problem. I've been amused listening to Issues and Answers and Face the Nation and some of the other national programs where some of his spokesmen are now blaming Congress. Congress gave him too much of a tax cut, and Congress didn't cut his budget in the right spots, and Congress raised the defense budgets. And a good example of this is the minimum Social Security benefit. The Reconciliation Act that was passed in July eliminated the $122 minimum benefit for Social Security. In September, the president comes back and says, I would like to restore that benefit. Most people thought that he was pro-minimum benefit, but it was his administration, his director of Office of Management and Budget, his senators, his House members, and his conservative Democrats who, in fact, eliminated that basic benefit. And we're now acting next Thursday to restore the minimum benefit in the House and Senate at the president's request because he knew what a blunder that was. And yet no one's blaming the president for meddling with Social Security cuts.
You mentioned before about how the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Water Project was just passed, and that was a special interest of Howard Baker's. I know you were a co-signer of a letter to him urging him to consider cutting friends from that project as he'd considered cutting friends from so many other programs. What powers do you have to lobby other people in the House or the Senate? We talked about what the president can do.
Well, clearly I don't have the stroke or the power or the pork barrel projects to give or take. And my letter to Senator Baker was stimulated after I watched Senator Baker and Congressman Bob Michael, the Republican leader in the House, come out of the White House. They went directly to the TV cameras and they looked up and said, the president has asked us to find 12% more cuts in the domestic budget, and we're going to have to ask congressmen and senators to be more courageous. And I thought to myself, well, if congressmen and senators are going to have to be more courageous, What about the $200 million we're committing every year between now and the year 1990 to build a water project that Senator Moynihan calls the clone of the Mississippi, from Pickwick, Tennessee to Mobile, Alabama? And almost at 100% federal expense, we're going to spend $20 million a month on a project that clearly should have local cost sharing. And if you looked at it in terms of building it today, you'd never even start that project. And just to put it in perspective, if you cut $100 million out of the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway appropriation for this year, you would still spend more on that water project than any other water project in the nation. I mean, the average expenditure is $5 to $10 million per project. Here we're talking about next year, $189 million, the following year, $200 million. This year we spent $225 million. It's just incredible that Senator Baker wouldn't be willing to sacrifice and cut even a few dollars out of that project as an example. And also in Tennessee is the Clinch River Breeder Reactor, which is an experimental nuclear reactor. I happen to think it's old technology, and there was a bipartisan effort in both the House and Senate to eliminate funding for that outmoded reactor process. But Senator Baker was not that courageous and did not stand up and speak out.
Well, we'll get to some of the other concerns of the Northeast Midwest Coalition in a few minutes, but what's the course that the B-1 and the MX are going to take now? Does the decision go through Congress now, and what kind of discussion is starting to gear up?
Well, we've been discussing the B-1 and the MX missile for years. In a vote in July on the MX missile system, an amendment in the House offered by Pat Schroeder and Ron Dellums got 96 votes to eliminate funding for the MX out of 435 congressmen. There clearly are no more than 100 congressmen willing to vote no against something like the MX. The president's new decision to limit the MX to the hardened Titan missile silos changes the debate somewhat. And there's an interesting article in the Washington Post today by Les Aspin saying that that's not a bad decision of the president because that gets us away from the mobile tracking system that was going to be put in place. And I can understand Les Aspin's thinking on that. I'm an opponent of the MX, and I will join with others who will try to fight even this new proposal as being negative. I think it's better than the old proposal, but it still has some major flaws. I think we need a strong practical defense system. I think we need spare parts. I think we need supply lines. I think we need an increase in our education of our military. I think we need a readiness capability to move troops very quickly. But I think we get over-fascinated with new toys and new technologies. The problem that we always face, and authorization bills and appropriation bills, is not just whether the MX is a good idea or a bad idea, or whether the B-1 is a good idea or a bad idea. The problem comes down to how many subcontractors there are throughout the nation who are dependent on that contract, how many of them are in whose congressional district, how many of them are lobbying individual congresspeople. And the real frustrating thing is a lot of the decisions on what is important for us strategically are not made in terms of the merits of the strategic arguments. Many times they're made in terms of whose congressional district benefits from this particular project, which air company is making the shells for these planes or these missiles. And we will have the appropriation bill before us very shortly. We will go through all the same arguments. But I want to be frank with you. I don't think there'll be anyone whose mind will change very much, and it looks to me like the president, his biggest discussion will be with those hawks who feel that his new MX system is wrong, and with those military thinking congressmen who think he hasn't bought enough B-1 bombers. The question of whether or not we ought to hold off on the B-1 and stretch out the FB-111 and use that as a penetrating force, and some of the arguments made in a new book by James Fallows entitled National Defense, I don't think we'll necessarily get to the floor of the House in terms of changing people's minds on either the MX or the B-1 bomber, and I think that's unfortunate.
Do you see any ways around military and defense decisions being made according to who profits economically from it?
It's really tough. I think we need some leadership from leaders in the House and Senate and in the White House to say, come on, let's be rational about our defense. Let's spend $1.3 trillion on defense rather than $1.6. Let's save $300 billion so we're not in deficit. And let's build a defense system that works, and let's not have the military-industrial complex wagging the dog. The only way we'll get to that is if we get public-private financing of congressional campaigns, if we recycle congressmen every 12, 16 years, whatever makes sense, and get to a point where congressmen serve to represent their best judgment and the interest of the nation and their districts rather than representing the interest of a special group of businessmen or targeted industries. An example of that is we add airplanes to the assembly line, not because they're needed, but because they're made in a particular district and they're important for that congressman's reelection. And I think we need to get to a point where we don't have to depend on private sector industries for campaign contributions so congressmen can speak and vote a little bit more courageously.
You know the story that broke the other day that Haig saying that someone in the administration who will go unnamed is waging guerrilla warfare against him, and this was seen as possibly indicative of a big split between Reagan and Haig. Do you know any more about that, and is that causing any suspicion or any feeling that maybe the brakes should be put on in some decisions for a while until things are cooled out or differences ironed out?
Well, you have in the personality of Alexander Haig a very volatile personality, and clearly he's going to not only anger some people within the administration, but he's going to raise their feelings that he ought to be recycled. I think that the reports are probably accurate that there is tension. The president has moved to ease that tension. You would like all of those fights to take place quietly within the White House so that it doesn't destabilize us around the world, because Alexander Haig's position is important. I guess my basic problem with Mr. Haig is that we have a person in a very sensitive diplomatic position who has a military mind and a rather strong will, so strong that it really antagonizes congressmen, senators, and clearly within the administration some people. I don't think Ronald Reagan's going to move to replace Alexander Haig. My hope is that they can begin to tone down some of the public demonstrations of their internal anger, because we need someone in that position as Secretary of State who can deal with the other nations of the world from a position of strength, but also from a position of negotiated settlement, not always thinking of sending bullets and military equipment to solve all the problems we face around the world.
Speaking with Congressman Bob Edgar, if you're just joining us, we hope to be able to open up the phones in just a few minutes. We've been talking about national and international issues, but let's look at the Delaware Valley for a few minutes. You're the chair of the Northeast Midwest Coalition, which is a coalition of a number of congressmen who are trying to prevent further economic decay of their regions. One of the great problems that we face in the Delaware Valley now is our public transportation system being on the verge of constant bankruptcy and we face enormous cutbacks. The schedules have already cut back. There's threats of more cutbacks in the near future. Is there any way that you could envision the federal government helping out SEPTA and other regional public transportation systems?
Well, let's be clear. The new administration in Washington has said it wants to eliminate all operation and maintenance funds to public transit systems by 1985, and they're working to reduce SEPTA's budget by 1985 in around 14% of its total operation and maintenance. I don't see anything on the horizon, particularly given our $80 billion of deficit, where public transit will get more money from the federal government. We may be able to fight very hard and keep the same level of funding, and I have a bill introduced that's getting some consideration around the country to change the present system and put a cap on how much operation and maintenance assistance can come to a public transit system of 15% and target that aid to maintaining the system, rehabilitating it and keeping it up, and leave the responsibility of operating that system to local revenues. That would mean that SEPTA would get a 1% increase rather than a decrease. It would bring down some cities like Los Angeles that get 30% of their operation and maintenance from the federal government, and a lot of smaller communities that may get as high as 40 or 50% of their revenues from the federal government. There is a role, in my opinion, for the federal government to provide 80% of the construction and capital needs and about 15% of the maintenance needs of that capital. But the long-term help for public transit, in my opinion, has to come from a recognition that public transit is a service. It cannot be operated at a profit, particularly in urban metropolitan areas where you have decaying systems that are deteriorating. And I think, frankly, in the Delaware Valley area, and this is an unpopular statement, but I'm going to make it because I feel strongly about it, we really need a regional transportation predictable funding base, either a regional tax on gasoline or a regional sales tax, so that SEPTA can operate, like many other transit systems in the nation, with a pool of predictable funds. It has to go hat in hand to the counties. There's a lot of politics involved in it. And I just think that we as a region have to recognize the importance and value of public transportation and provide a funding base like Atlanta and Chicago and other metropolitan areas do, so that the managers of SEPTA can do more than just patch the system together. You mentioned about them cutting back on service. We ought to be expanding service. We ought to be thinking creatively. I was up in Canada about 6 months ago and discovered a system called Erica. And it's a computerized system, costs $5,000 per bus and some software at the terminal, where you can dial. You can dial your telephone. The first three numbers give you access to the computer. The second two numbers are your bus route, and the final two numbers are your bus stop. And a little computerized voice comes on and says, your bus will be at your bus stop in 8 minutes. The next bus will be there in 46 minutes. And through a signaling mechanism, it tells you how long it takes to get the bus. They discovered that most of the people riding their system don't like the long waits at the bus stop. This way, if you know it takes you 3 minutes to walk to your bus stop, you can walk out in 4 minutes. The bus is there. And tremendously creative. They increased their ridership in Toronto by something like 35% because of this computerized system. You know, we haven't thought about that because we've been so busy surviving. So SEPTA needs a predictable funding base so that its management can be free to be creative.
Are you worried about what would happen if there is another oil shortage and the public transportation systems are crumbling as well?
There is going to be another oil crisis. We're in a glut situation now, but frankly, we're running out of fossil fuel oil and natural gas, at least in easily accessible commodities of it. And I'm worried that we're not going to repair and maintain our public transit systems. We're not going to adequately fund them for the next 5 years. And we're going to have increased dependence on our private automobile at the very time when, both by cost and by supply, we won't have those substantive. So I would think we need to be creative at this point and invest in our public transit systems, make the ones we have work, not necessarily be fascinated with new technology and reinventing the trolley and reinventing high sophisticated people movers, but just in the basic meat and potatoes public transit system, I think we need to make a major investment to keep our systems rolling in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Pittsburgh, Chicago, the basic older cities of our nation.
Let me invite our listeners to call with any questions. My guest is Congressman Bob Edgar of Delaware County, and you can call now if you have any questions you'd like to ask him. Our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. Again, the number is 923-2774. And I should mention that you can also have an opportunity to hear him talk this evening at a series at the Christian Association on the Penn campus. It's the series Personal Values and Public Policy. That will be this evening. For more information, you can call 386-1530. Before we get to the phones, I know you're also very active in a number of veterans issues. What I think you had a bill that just passed.
Yes, the president signed on Tuesday a new health and education bill for veterans, which does two important things. It reauthorizes for 3 years the 91 readjustment counseling centers for Vietnam-era veterans, and this is an exciting and important service to provide storefront counseling centers. We have one here in Philadelphia. Second thing it does is it expands the Agent Orange study to look at the use of defoliants in Vietnam and their causing of systemic diseases among veterans. And it expands that study to look at all of the defoliants and not just the Agent Orange, which has caused a great deal of concern recently.
One more thing before we get to the phones. I recently went through the Paul Songer's book, which is a reevaluation of liberalism, and I know you've just read it, and I imagine a number of people in Washington are reading it now. What's your evaluation of his evaluation of liberalism, the course it's heading in and should be heading in?
I think it's a book well worth reading. I think it's the first in a series of new opportunities for Democrats particularly, but also moderate Republicans, to begin to think in some new models and some new images. And if and when Ronald Reagan stubs his toe, and if and when we begin to say, are there other economic possibilities and other theories and other programs for dealing with the problems we face as a nation, here are some new models. And Paul Tsongas from Massachusetts has offered one suggestion. I like his illustration that we're a nation that's really in a canoe lazily going down a beautiful stream, but we're not aware of when the waterfalls are going to come. The waterfalls in terms of toxic disposal, the waterfalls in terms of land use, the waterfalls in terms of clean air and clean water, the waterfalls in terms of our economic distress. And we need some new models to deal with the crisis that we are coming. And he offers some suggestions. Chris Dodd, a new senator from Connecticut, is also in the midst of writing a new book. Bill Bradley from New Jersey and some of the members of Congress, myself, Dick Ottinger, and Tim Wirth, are part of some new task forces looking at some new economic directions, some new models for developing programs. And I think you're going to hear a lot about that as we move in the next 6 months. And it's just a new effort to say, while some of the old programs work, maybe there are some new ideas, new coalitions, new associations with people that will help us in the future. And even, I think Paul is the beginning of some new leadership that we're looking for within the Democratic Party. I think people think of Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts, not very much of, and Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts, but Paul is the other senator from Massachusetts replacing Senator Brooke, and I think a very outstanding, bright mind that will be on the leadership horizon.
But I take it the course you're going to chart out is going to be somewhat different than the one he has.
Not too much different. Paul and I have a lot of common thoughts, and I guess what we're working on are more of the details. Paul tends to be writing an umbrella under which a lot of people have to fill in the pieces, and I'm going to hopefully fill in the pieces on water policy, transportation policy, and veteran policy.
Okay, Congressman Bob Edgar is my guest. Our number is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yo, I'd like to congratulate you on another great show, Terry, and I'd like to congratulate the congressman for being one of the outstanding legislators in the Delaware Valley area. My question concerns the New Jersey gubernatorial election. The whole nation is watching this stunning deadlock cliffhanger, and certainly an object lesson in civics and the importance of a citizen to participate in selecting his government leaders. During the summer, one Terry Dolan, the NCPAC fanatic, had spoken around this area, WCAU radio here in Philadelphia, the McNeil Air Report, and where he threatened to target certain congressmen. Congressman Edgar was one of those congressmen, as well as Congressman James Florio. What I'd like to ask Congressman Edgar is, does he know if whether or not Dolan was active, and as he had threatened, with a financial war chest in the congressional district of Jim Florio? Jim Florio did not do as well in his own congressional district or in that area as he had expected. Number two, the Reverend Carl McIntyre, who was one of the original moral majority type radio preachers, is also in that area. So it is my belief that that area would be particularly sensitive to the types of issues that a NCPAC group would go in there to try to stir up vicious and deceitful attacks against somebody like Congressman Florio. Secondly, does he think that the Republican National Committee, which sent in an extra $800,000 on behalf of Tom Kaine for the so-called negative advertisement spending, was fair? In other words, it enabled Kaine to spend about 50% more than Florio. And one last thing. On Friday afternoon, the Federal Reserve Board lowered the discount rate, 1 percentage point. That had the effect of sending the stock market up about $20 on Friday, and the market continued to go up on Election Eve Monday, $14 more. Does he think that that favored the Republicans in their local elections across the nation, and that 3 days before the Federal Reserve had lowered the discount rate, the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve made the statement the Fed will not cave in to political pressure, and so it was sort of something of an about-face a little bit in a brief period of time. I'd really appreciate the congressman's comments on these.
Yeah, let me be very quick, because I know there are other people who want to talk. Terry Dolan's been very active in the area, targeting both Jim Florio and myself for recycling and spent some money. I think his impact was visible within New Jersey, and the point that you make about Carl McIntyre beginning to fertilize the field very early, particularly among fundamentalist, conservative Christian thinkers, may have had some impact, but I don't think that it accounts for the virtual tie between the two candidates in New Jersey. Your point about the National Republican financial help in New Jersey is an interesting one. The Republican Party, particularly the conservative wing of the Republican Party, has been able and more able than the moderate to liberal wing of the Democratic Party to raise funds, raising funds in terms of one issue, special interest politics, raising funds in terms of targeted issues. And they're going to spend maybe as much as $25 million to recycle some of the congressmen in next year's election. And I think this is just a beginning of that tide. And I think where the Democratic Party has people, the Republican Party at this point in history has money. And we're going to see the confrontation between the money and the people for a long time. I don't think either of those events, either the money from the National Republican Party nor the Terry Dolan, Carl McIntyre event, were enough to erode the problems that Jim Florio has experienced in the last week. Frankly, I think the unpopularity of Governor Byrne and the issue of naming the arena up in the Meadowlands after Governor Byrne that the commission did had a great negative impact on Jim Florio.
I agree with you.
Jim's inability to separate himself from Governor Byrne did not help in the last days.
He had done that very successfully for most of the campaign, but within the last 2-3 weeks, the New York Times did run an article to that effect, connecting Florio with Byrne, and Kane pounced on it with that $800,000 in his advertisements. You're absolutely right.
That's right. To your last point about lower discount rates, I don't think the Federal Reserve is playing politics with that. I think it was just time for them to move on that issue, and it's interesting. I think it's part of a plan.
Thanks very much for your call. Before we get to the next caller, let me ask you, do you have any analysis of the way the elections went? Do you think you can make any kind of generalizations about the mood of the country or whether the Republican stronghold is still there?
I think that there really is only one barometer in an off-year election, particularly this off-year election, that we can use to see what's happening nationally. I think most of the local election results, the Democrats winning in Philadelphia, the Republicans winning overwhelmingly in Delaware County, indicate to me that most people who went to the polls to vote voted party preference and probably didn't know the candidates they were voting for. There were so many names on the ballot, and I told some of the reporters the evening of the election in Delaware County that it would have been a fun experience for them to go out the next day, find people who voted, and ask them two questions. First, who did you vote for? My guess is they couldn't tell you. And secondly, why did they vote for those persons? I don't think they knew other than civic duty. We had an indicted candidate in Delaware County win by a 2-to-1 margin over his challenger. I don't think that many people who went to the polls even knew that he was indicted. But the one indicator that I saw were the two governor's races. And I think clearly in Virginia, where Rob soft-pedaled his anger with Reagan economics and just ran on a basic Democratic versus Republican but conservative tone, the Democrat won in a fairly conservative, should-lean Republican state. So that brings us up to New Jersey. Why didn't Jim do better? I think the tying to Byrne was one indicator, but also I think Jim went nose to nose with Ronald Reagan. And I don't think the average citizen understands the fine print of some of the things that Reagan is about. And the message hasn't gotten out yet that some of the high deficits are caused by Reagan economic policy. Reagan is very skillful in separating himself from that, and I think beating Reagan on the head was not helpful to Jim Florio. The president has enormous personal capital that's still out there, and I think that it shows in the Florio closeness of that campaign and shows in the fact that Governor Robb kind of tied himself with Ronald Reagan and was not very cranky with the new president.
Okay, well, let's take another phone call. I'm speaking with Congressman Bob Edgar, Democrat from Delaware County. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon to both of you.
Let me just ask you before we start to keep it very brief because we're short on time.
Right. I regret very much that I tuned in late and I didn't hear the entire program. First of all, I'd like to say that it would be good, I think, if I don't know how to put this. I know that a lot of other Vietnam vets have the type of thinking that I have, but I'll just say as an individual, I would like to express something maybe those of you at the station can pass on to the people working at public television who are next Wednesday night at 8 o'clock going to present a special on the Vietnam veteran, which has been criticized by some of the organized national so-called veterans groups because of portraying Vietnam veterans as junkies, alcoholics, so on and so forth. I have faith in public television that it's going to be done in very good taste.
Sir, let me just tell you, we're really running short on time, so if you have a question for Congressman Edgar,
yes.
If you could get to the question.
Okay. When President Reagan was in town this past about a month ago, or more or less, I was in town outside there for a few hours, and I held a sign that said, government ignores Vietnam vets. And I know that Mr. Reagan saw the sign because it was actually the only sign on that block when he came out of the building. I happened to be, fortunately, inside the doorway of the building when all the people out standing on the sidewalk had been ushered away from the block. And
let me respond to your comment. I think you're right. Up until now, the federal government has ignored many of the needs for the Vietnam veteran. But let me just say, I think it's changing. The House Veterans Affairs Committee is less oriented simply to World War II career veterans. Many more of us are young committee chairmen who are interested in issues like delayed stress syndrome, Agent Orange, readjustment counseling centers. And the point that you made earlier is important. Most of the Vietnam veterans who came back are making out very well. They're good and well-respected citizens in their community, and they are owed a great service from our country, and we ought to figure out ways to applaud their service. I think we need to narrow the help to those who, because of vocational needs or drug addiction or other problems that they experienced having served in Vietnam, we need to address those needs. And we do that, I think, by the storefront counseling centers, by expanding the vocational education programs, and by reaching out and loving them in a unique way. And I respect your sign as well as your enthusiasm to raise the level of consciousness on the needs for Vietnam-era veterans.
Thank you for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and I'm going to have to ask you to
yes,
keep it
I will
brief.
Keep it brief. I heard a report on NPR about the callous treatment of refugees from El Salvador by this government, and I was just wondering if there's anything that can be done to get our government to have a more humane policy for treatment of these refugees whose plight, to some extent, is our fault.
Yeah, I think that report has been accurate, and we've been trying to follow in our office some of the reports of harassment on Salvadorian refugees who are fleeing the violence that has been perpetrated in that country, not just by what are the so-called guerrilla forces, but in large extent by the very military that we're giving bullets and helicopters to. There are some things we can do. You can make your congressmen and senators aware that the problem exists. You can communicate with the congressional offices of each of those congressmen and senators when you hear of abuse taking place. And you can communicate by phone and by mail with those offices your concern that while we have to respect the immigration laws, there are certain countries where human rights violations are so severe and where the confrontation with the citizens are so distressful that our country really has to begin to shape a policy to bring them into an environment of peace rather than leaving them in an environment of terrorism.
Good, thanks.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Please keep your question brief.
Okay, yes. I have a basic question about, you referred before to Senator Tsongas' book, and there's been a lot of critiques to the effect that for reasons of immediate, I don't know, word political expediency is a little harsh, but something in that field, that some of the old basic constituency of the Democratic Party, of minorities, of poor people, of just generally people who need public funding, have been sacrificed for just the greater end of coming back to an election once the Reagan begins to falter. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I don't think that Paul Tsongas' book can be argued that he is not compassionate to those groups. I don't think it's a matter of not addressing the needs of our traditional coalitions of poor people and of the elderly, but I think it's growing interest in new coalitions. For example, the Democratic Party has ignored small businesses, and yet the lifeblood of our region, the lifeblood of our nation, is the incubation of small, growing businesses. And I don't think that it hurts us to be compassionate for some of those small businesses who get caught up in the struggle. Hubert Humphrey, I think, has a good comment for all of us at this time. He says, the moral test of government is how it treats those in the dawn of life, its children, how it treats those in the twilight of life, the elderly, and how it treats those in the shadows of life, the sick, the poor, and the handicapped. I would add to that quote, small businesses, the earth in terms of conservation. I would add to that just a basic recognition of human rights and human rights violations around the world. And I think what Paul is trying to do, Paul Tsongas, is trying to help us raise some new language, recognizing that federal policy has to be at the same time flexible, dealing with the new areas of growth in the South and West, while it's also concerned about the older areas of rehabilitation and reconstruction. So it's got to have flexible public policy and a targeted public policy. And how do you do that? How do you build new coalitions to target less federal dollars, less state dollars, and maximize their impact to help the poor, the elderly, the sick, the infirmed, the small business, protect the environment, and deal with some of the kind of human issues that we're going to face as we go down this river facing incredible waterfalls that are in front of us?
Thanks very much for your phone call. Bye-bye. Well, we're very short on time. I think that you've said you would only run for four terms, and is that
actually
right?
No, my commitment has been that I'll run for six terms.
For six terms, okay.
12 years, and I'm a co-sponsor of a bill that would change the number of years that a congressman serves from 2 to 4 years, but limit the number of terms to 3 so that we'd recycle ourselves every 12 years. So I'm committed to running for re-election in 82 and in 84, which if I win election, it's always tough in Delaware County. I will serve for 5 more years, a total of 12 years, and then I'll go do something else. I'll either run for the Senate or the governor's race or go back to a college campus or find some other place to make an imprint.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today and for answering some of the questions of our listeners, and I hope that you can come visit with us again sometime on Fresh Air.
I look forward to it.
I've been speaking with Congressman Bob Edgar of Delaware County. He's now serving his fourth term. He's the chairman of the Northeast Midwest Coalition. And he will, by the way, be speaking this evening in Philadelphia if you'd like to meet him or hear him speak. The Christian Association has an ongoing series called Personal Values and Public Policy. And Bob Edgar will be the speaker this evening. This is at 3601 Locust Walk in the Christian Association. More information can be obtained at 386-1530. That's 386-1530. Well, just enough time for me to tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on the program. At 2 o'clock, my guest will be singer Joan LaBarbera. Eddie Fisher will be with us after that. You may know he's written a book called My Life, My Loves. Rona Jaffe, the novelist, will be with us at about 3. At 3:30, our film critic Bill Van Wert reviews the new film Prince of the City, And at 4 o'clock for a return visit to Fresh Air is Sheila Kitzinger, who's a British woman who's an expert in different approaches to natural childbirth and to breastfeeding. And we hope to also open up the telephones when she joins us tomorrow at 4. So I hope you can be with us then. Contributing to today's show was Frances Davis. Technical directors were Stephen Waterman and Rob Richards. The production assistant for the program is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I wish you a very good evening. WUHY FM in Philadelphia, listener supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
They're beginning by gutting the regulations, for example. You change the definition of what kind of a source of pollution has to have a federal permit. You allow people to build tall stacks instead of putting on pollution controls. And of course, one major way is to change what is defined as healthy air.
Clean air, it turns out, is in the mind of those who breathe it. Or you might say, in the regulations of those who define it. Tonight on All Things Considered, the anti-regulatory mood of the Reagan administration spreads to pollution controls.
Also tonight, these stories, the Secretary of State and the President's National Security Advisor get together in a display of good feeling.
But meanwhile, the Secretary of Defense contradicts remarks made yesterday by the Secretary of State.
So the confusion over foreign policy continues.
The Sinai peacekeeping force, part of the Camp David Accords, in trouble from several directions.
A new warning about the dangers of low-level radiation.
A congressman who knows how to find the silver lining.
No frills, but books. You're supposed to enjoy them, but not too much.
Thoughts on self-sufficiency from a Kentucky sage.
And the latest in dating habits.
Dullness can be stimulating.
On All Things Considered, first here's news from Alan Risley.
The case of that Soviet submarine that ran aground in Sweden 10 days ago took a startling new turn today. Swedish Prime Minister Torbjörn Fälldin announced that the sub is probably armed with nuclear weapons, but he says it's free to return to Russia whenever the weather permits. Roger Wallace has a report.
Mr. Fälldin said that in all probability it was armed with nuclear warheads and that it was carrying quantities of uranium-238.